verse 1 and following, Luke 24, verse 1 and following, and John 20, verse 1 and following, that Mary Magdalene, Mary the mother of James, Salome, Jonah, plus Peter and John went to the tomb where Jesus was laid. They did not find Jesus because the tomb was empty. Jesus was raised from the dead. This gives us hope of a resurrection. If the tomb was not empty, then Jesus was just another man. But the tomb was empty because Jesus is God. Thanks be to God for the empty tomb. The empty tomb is central or the foundation of Christianity. The gospel is founded on Jesus' resurrection. Two of the gospel writers, Matthew and John, were eyewitnesses of the risen Jesus. On the Sunday morning after Jesus was crucified, the huge stone which was rolled in front of the entrance to the tomb of Jesus had been moved. In Mark 16:4, when the women came to the tomb, they discovered that the stone had been rolled away. The Greek word for rolled away indicates that the stone had been moved away from the entrance to the tomb altogether. The stone had not been pushed open just a crack. There was some distance between the huge rock and the tomb entrance. In John 20, verse 1, the Greek word John uses means to pick up something and carry it away. Josephus, a Jewish historian in the first century, wrote that the stone was so large that 20 men couldn't move it. I kind of doubt that, but that's what he wrote. Who then moved the stone? The Roman guards did not move the stone. They were on duty to make sure that no one broke into the tomb of Jesus and stole his body. They had placed a seal of the Roman emperor on the stone, Matthew 27:66. This was to indicate that the contents of the tomb were not to be tampered with, since they belonged to Caesar. The Roman guards would have been executed had they moved the stone. The women who came to the tomb did not move the stone. As they went to the tomb, they were asking themselves who would move the stone, Mark 16:3. They realized that they were not physically strong enough to move the stone. The disciples did not move the stone. They did not learn that the tomb of Jesus was empty until the women came and told them, Luke 24:9. When they were told the tomb was empty, the words appeared to them as nonsense, and they would not believe the women, Luke 24:11. How was the stone moved? A great earthquake occurred, and an angel of the Lord descended from heaven and rolled back the stone from the entrance to the tomb and sat on it, Matthew 28:2. The angel said to the women, "He is not here, for he is risen. Come, see the place where he lay," Matthew 28:6. The Roman guards were afraid of this angel, whose appearance was like lightning and whose clothes were white as snow. Matthew writes that the guards became like dead men, Matthew 28:4. In Matthew 28:11 through 15, the guards went into the city and reported to the chief priest what had happened. The elders consulted together and gave a large sum of money to the soldiers and told them to say the disciples came by night and stole him away while they were asleep. This story was widely spread among the Jews. Asleep on guard duty? If you've been in the military, you know that's about the worst thing you can do. Josh McDowell has written a defense of the resurrection of Jesus Christ entitled "The Resurrection Factor." He writes, quote, Many theories have been advanced attempting to show that the resurrection of Jesus Christ was a fraud. Historians have to become anti-historical in order to invent some of their ideas, end of quote. Man thinks that he has better idea than what God has said he did. Man's theories are just that, man's theories. One of these theories is the unknown grave. Charles Guggenbert, in his book Jesus, writes, quote, "The truth is that we do not know, in all probability the disciples knew no better, where the body of Jesus had been thrown after he had been removed from the cross, probably by the executioners. It is more likely to have been cast into the pit for the executed than laid in any new tomb," end of quote. John Dominic Crossan believes that the body of Jesus was never placed in a tomb. He thinks that the body of Jesus was taken down from the cross and thrown into a pit for common criminals, and that the disciples did not know where he was buried. He asserts, quote, "If, as I maintain, Jesus' followers had fled upon his arrest and knew nothing whatsoever about his fate beyond the fact of execution itself, the horror was not only that he had been executed, but that he might not even have been decently buried. With regard to the body of Jesus, by Easter Sunday morning, those who cared did not know where it was, and those who knew did not care. Why should even the soldiers themselves remember the death and disposal of a nobody?" End of quote. The beliefs of Guggenbert and Crossan are contrary to the eyewitness accounts recorded in the Gospels. Some of the eyewitnesses of the burial were women who sat opposite of the tomb. Mark writes, "Mary Magdalene and Mary the mother of Joses saw where he was laid," Mark 15:47. Matthew writes, "Mary Magdalene and the other Mary were there, sitting opposite the sepulcher," Matthew 27:61. Luke writes, "The women who had come with him from Galilee followed and saw the tomb and how his body was laid," Luke 23:55. The writing of Matthew, Mark, and Luke support the view that the body of Jesus was placed in the tomb of Joseph of Arimathea after it was taken down from the cross. The Roman soldiers knew where the tomb was located as well, as they were sent by Pilate to guard the tomb of Jesus to prevent the disciples from stealing the body, Matthew 27:62-66. In June of 1968, an ossuary was discovered in a buried cave in northern Jerusalem. An ossuary is a bone box. It's about so long, so wide, about so high with a lid. It's carved out of sandstone. Some were very plain. Some were highly decorated with carvings. And they were used from about 100 BC to 70 AD. And sometimes the name of the persons whose bones was in the box was scratched on the top. When a person died, they would be placed in a tomb, and then after about a year, the family would come into the tomb, pick up the bones, and put them in this bone box, and then the tomb could be used again. This ossuary contained the bones of an adult male who had died by crucifixion sometime during the first half of the first century. Initial study of the skeletal remains indicate that a nail was driven through each of his forearms at the hand, and a single nail had been driven through his heel bones. The nail was still embedded in his heel bones. This discovery is an argument against the view that criminals were thrown into a common pit after they died on crosses. The fact that the man was crucified did not prevent those who cared for him from burying him in an ossuary box. Another theory is the wrong tomb. Professor Croson Lake advocates the wrong tomb theory. He writes in his book, The Historical Evidence for the Resurrection of Jesus, quote, "It is seriously a matter of doubt whether the women were really in a position to be quite certain that the tomb which they visited was that in which they had seen Joseph of Arimathea bury the Lord's body. The neighborhood of Jerusalem is full of rock tombs, and it would not be easy to distinguish one from another without careful note. If so, they would have had but a limited power to distinguish between one rock tomb and another close to it. The possibility, therefore, that they came to the wrong tomb is to be reckoned with, and it is important because it supplies the natural explanation of the fact that whereas they had seen the tomb closed, they found it open. They expected to find a closed tomb, but they found an open one, and a young man, who guesses their errand, tried to tell them they had made a mistake. He is not here. See the place where they laid him," and probably pointed to the next tomb. End of quote. There are several problems with the wrong tomb theory. One, some women did see where Joseph of Arimathea and Nicodemus buried the body of Jesus, Matthew 27:61. Two, when the women were coming to the tomb to anoint the body of Jesus, they were discussing the problem of the huge stone that was rolled in front of the entrance to the tomb, Mark 16:3. Three, if the women went to the wrong tomb, then the Jews or the Romans could have gone to the right tomb and produced the body of Jesus, and that would have stopped the story that Jesus was raised from the dead. The fact that the Jews bribed the Roman guard to say that the disciples of Jesus stole his body while they slept at night is evidence of the fact that they could not produce the body of Jesus because it was gone. Some argue that the resurrection accounts in the gospel are just legends that were invented by the church a few decades after Jesus' death. Robert Funk writes, "Legends may be subdivided into two subtypes, biographical legends and cult legends. A biographical legend is a story that casts a supernatural aura around the hero. A cult legend accounts in story form for the establishment of some ritual practices in the Jesus movement. The depiction of the Last Supper is also just such a cult legend. The resurrection accounts in the gospel are not legends. Two of the four gospels were written down by witnesses, Matthew and John, and the other two gospels, Mark and Luke, were associated with two apostles who lived during the time of Jesus, Peter and Paul. Paul stated in 1 Corinthians 15:6 that they were 500 witnesses of the risen Christ, and that some were still alive at the time of his writing of the book of 1 Corinthians, which most scholars date around AD 55-56. Robert Funk's liberal bias prevents him from seeing the truth of the resurrection of Jesus Christ. The spiritual resurrection view is that Christ's resurrection was not a real physical bodily resurrection. Proponents of this theory assert that Christ's body remained in the grave and that his resurrection was spiritual in nature. This view can be refuted by looking at what the risen Jesus did after his resurrection. The risen Jesus first appeared to Mary Magdalene. When she recognized Jesus by his voice, she apparently began to cling to him. She could not have clung to a ghost. Jesus told her, "Do not cling to me, for I have not yet ascended to my Father. but go to my brethren and say to them, I am ascending to my Father and your Father, and to my God and your God. John 20:17. The risen Jesus startled his disciples when he appeared before them on Sunday night after his resurrection. The disciples were terrified and thought that they were seeing a ghost. Jesus said to them, Why are you troubled, and why do doubts arise in your hearts? Behold my hands and my feet, it is I myself. Handle and see, for a spirit does not have flesh and bones, as you see I have. When he had said this, he showed them his hands and feet. Luke 24:41-42. He showed his disciples his hands and feet to prove to them that he was the same Jesus whose hands and feet were nailed to the cross. The resurrected body of Jesus had the scars or marks of the crucifixion in it. Jesus even ate a piece of broiled fish before the disciples so they would understand that he was not a ghost, but he was resurrected from the dead. When the apostles told Thomas that they had seen the Lord, Thomas said, Unless I see in his hands the print of the nails, and put my finger into the print of the nails, and put my hand into his side, I will not believe. John 20:25. Thomas was a skeptic who refused to believe unless he could see with his own two eyes the resurrected Jesus. 8 days after his resurrection, the disciples were gathered together behind closed doors when Jesus suddenly appeared in their midst. Jesus said to Thomas, Reach your finger here and look at my hands, and reach your hand here and put it into my side. Do not be unbelieving, but believing. John 20:27. We do not know from John's gospel if Thomas touched Jesus or not, but Thomas did acknowledge who was standing before him. He spoke to Jesus and said, My Lord and my God. John 20:28. The earliest fabrication explaining the empty tomb of Jesus was a lie that the disciples stole the body of Jesus from the tomb. Could the disciples have stolen the body of Jesus? There are several problems with this view. First, the tomb of Jesus was well guarded. There were possibly 4 to 16 Roman soldiers protecting the tomb. Each Roman soldier was trained to protect 6 feet of ground. 4 men would be placed in front of what they were to protect, while the other 12 would sleep in a semicircle in front of them with their heads pointed in towards the other guards. To steal the body of Jesus, the disciples would have had to walk past the sleeping Roman soldiers without waking them, then fight off the other 4 experienced soldiers, move the huge stone, steal the body of Jesus, and leave the grave clothes, and then slip past the sleeping guards. Second, the Roman soldiers were bribed to tell the story that the disciples came and stole the body. Why would the chief priests pay this bribe to the Roman soldiers? They had to be bribed because by telling a lie, they would be putting their lives on the line. The Roman soldiers knew that to say that they were asleep when they should have been awake and on duty would be to incriminate themselves. The penalty for a Roman soldier who slept on guard was death. That is why the chief priests say that if the news reached the governor's ears, they would appease him and make the soldier secure. The fact that the soldiers were accountable ultimately to Governor Pilate shows that these were Roman soldiers and not just some Jewish police who were guarding the tomb of Jesus. The Roman soldiers could not have known that the disciples stole the body of Jesus if they were sleeping. Also, it would be likely that all the Roman soldiers would sleep at the same time. Finally, the disciples were not in a psychological state to try to steal the body of Jesus from the tomb. The disciples fled from Jesus when he was arrested in the Garden of Gethsemane. Peter denied he knew Jesus. And on the Sunday night after Jesus was crucified, the disciples were behind locked doors. Why? They were afraid of the Jews, John 20:19. Another theory is theft by the authorities. Now, this theory doesn't make sense. If the Jewish or Roman authorities had the body of Jesus, why did they bribe the guards to accuse the disciples of stealing it? Matthew 28:11-15. They could have stopped the resurrection story by simply producing the body of Jesus and showing it around Jerusalem. Instead, the Jewish authorities scolded the apostles for filling Jerusalem with their teaching, arrested them, and beat them. They became so upset with Stephen that they stoned him to death, Acts 7. Another theory is the resuscitation theory, or sometimes called a swoon theory. This view teaches that Jesus never really died on the cross. He only swooned or fainted. Later, he revived in the cool air of the tomb and left. This theory completely ignores the evidence for the death of Jesus on the cross. There is no evidence that Jesus was drugged. When the Roman soldiers offered Jesus wine mixed with myrrh, Jesus turned down the common painkiller that was usually given to crucifixion victims, Mark 15:23. Just before his death, he was given a sip of sour wine to relieve his parched throat, but that was not enough to drug him. Jesus experienced a heavy loss of blood as a result of his flogging before crucifixion and on the cross as a result of his hands and feet being nailed to the cross. He also lost blood when the Roman soldier thrust his spear into his side, and water and blood immediately flowed out, John 19:34. Jesus would have been weak from this loss of blood. Plus, he had not had anything to eat, so he would have been too weak to move the stone, plus being flogged. Usually, the Roman soldiers would break the legs of the crucified to hasten death. The legs of Jesus were not broken by the soldiers because the soldiers recognized that Jesus was already dead, John 19:33. Pilate asked for assurance that Jesus was really dead before releasing the body for burial, Mark 15:43-45. The fact that Pilate permitted Joseph of Arimathea to take the body of Jesus after obtaining confirmation of Jesus' death from the Roman centurion is another proof of the death of Jesus. Even if he did wake up in the tomb, he could not have unwrapped himself, rolled a huge stone back up the side of the carved-out track, overcome the guards, and escaped unnoticed. Medical doctor William Edward writes, "Clearly the weight of historical and medical evidence indicates that Jesus was dead before the wound to his side was inflicted and supports a traditional view that the spear thrust between his right ribs probably perforated not only the right lung, but also the heart, thereby ensuring his death. Accordingly, interpretations based on the assumption that Jesus did not die on the cross appear at odds with modern medical knowledge." A second problem with the resuscitation view is the undisturbed linen wrappings of Jesus. Jesus would have had to pull off a magic trick to get out of the wrappings and then leave them undisturbed in the place where he was laid. This would have been an impossible task for the person who was wrapped. Peter noticed that the face cloth, which had been on his head, was not with the linen wrappings, but was rolled up in a place by itself. When John saw this, he believed that Jesus was raised from the dead. Another theory is the hallucination view that says the disciples thought they saw the risen Jesus, but they really did not. According to this view, the disciples had hallucinations or visions of Jesus after his death. The disciples imagined that they saw Jesus, and that was enough for them to declare that Jesus was alive. Marcus Borg, a leader in the Jesus Seminar, thinks that, quote, the story of the historical Jesus ends with his death on a Friday in A.D. 30. The story of Jesus does not end there. According to Jesus' followers, he appeared to them in a new way beginning on Easter Sunday, end of quote. Borg rejects the bodily resurrection of Jesus and claims that we cannot know what form the appearance of Jesus took, since Borg says that they are described as visionary and other times as corporal. There are several ways of refuting the hallucination view. First, the hallucination view fails to account for the appearance of Jesus to various individuals and groups of people at different times and places. By definition, a hallucination is a private event, a purely subjective experience void of any external reference or object. Psychologist Gary Collins says, quote, hallucinations are individual occurrences. By their very nature, only one person can see a given hallucination at a time. They certainly aren't something which can be seen by a group of people. Neither is it possible that one person could somehow induce a hallucination in someone else. Since an hallucination exists only in this subjective, personal sense, it is obvious that others cannot witness this, end of quote. The Gospels tell us that the risen Jesus appeared to many different people at different times and places. The risen Jesus appeared to Mary Magdalene, to Peter, to the two disciples on the road to Emmaus, to the apostles, and to the apostles as a group with a skeptic named Thomas. He wouldn't believe unless he physically saw the risen Jesus, and later Jesus appeared to a persecutor of the church who afterward would become the great Apostle Paul. The risen Jesus appeared to 500 people at one time. How does one explain 500 people having the same hallucination at the same time? Second, the hallucination view fails to account for the initial unbelief of the disciples. The disciples did not initially believe the reports of the empty tomb, and that later they were amazed when they saw the risen Jesus. Jesus himself rebuked the disciples for their unbelief, Mark 16:14. Third, the hallucination view fails to account for the surprise of the disciples at the appearance of the risen Jesus. People who have hallucinations often are expectant and are looking for something. The Gospels tell us that on that first Sunday, the disciples were fearful and were in hiding for their lives. They did not expect the risen Jesus to suddenly appear. Luke tells us in his Gospel that the disciples were terrified and frightened when the risen Jesus appeared to them. They thought they saw a ghost or a spirit, but Jesus proved that he was not an hallucination or spirit by showing them his hands and feet with the crucifixion marks. And then by eating some broiled fish in their presence, Luke 24:36-43. Jesus proved to them over 40 days between his resurrection and his ascension that he was risen from the dead. Another theory is the impersonation view. In the Passover plot, Hugh Schoenfield proposes that Jesus tried to deceive his disciples into thinking he was the Messiah. To fulfill Old Testament prophecy, he plotted with Joseph of Arimathea to receive a drug while on the cross. The scheme supposedly backfired when the Roman soldier thrust a spear into Jesus, so he died. Before dawn, the body of Jesus was then supposedly taken down quickly from the cross and disposed of in an unknown grave. An unknown young man was then supposedly mistaken as Jesus by an emotionally distraught Mary and the confused disciples. Neither Joseph of Arimathea nor the mysterious young man ever corrected the confused disciples. The disciples then supposedly spread the story that Jesus had risen from the dead. There are many problems with Schoenfield's view. First, the arguments presented against the unknown grave can be used here as well. Several women, along with Joseph of Arimathea and Nicodemus, saw where Jesus was buried. He was not thrown into an unmarked grave. Second, several disciples saw and recognized Jesus. They were not confused about the identity of Jesus. Mary Magdalene did recognize the man in the garden as Jesus. She recognized him by the sound of his voice and the way he said her name. The two disciples on the road to Emmaus would not have turned around and come back if they did not believe that they had seen the risen Lord. Luke 24:13-32. Thomas recognized Jesus when he saw him hold out his hands, which bore the marks of crucifixion. John 20:26-29. Peter preached the death and resurrection of Jesus to the Jews on the day of Pentecost, Acts 2:23-35. Paul preached the resurrection of Jesus in his sermons and his legal defense when he was on trial, Acts 13. In 1878, a marble slab, 24 inches by 15 inches, was discovered in Nazareth, which contained an ordinance of Caesar. This was issued by Roman Emperor Claudius between AD 41 and 54. It was written in Greek. The translation is, quote, "Ordinance of Caesar. It is my pleasure that graves and tombs remain perpetually undisturbed for those who have made them for the cult of their ancestors or children or members of their house. If, however, anyone charges that another has either demolished them or has in any other way extracted the buried or has maliciously transferred the sealing on one stone, against such a one I order that a trial be instituted as in respect of the gods, so in regard to the cult of mortals. For it shall be much more obligatory to honor the buried. Let it be absolutely forbidden for anyone to disturb them. In case of violation, I desire that the offender be sentenced to capital punishment on charges of violating of sepulcher." End of quote. The punishment for the crime of grave robbing was made a capital offense and punishable by death. Is it possible that Claudius heard about the Christians' teaching of the resurrection of Jesus and the Jewish report about the soldiers, about the disciples stealing the body of Jesus from the tomb guarded by Roman soldiers? When the existence of an all-powerful God is recognized, then miracles and the resurrection of Jesus is more plausible than any of the theories made by man. The empty tomb of Jesus is best explained by the bodily resurrection of Jesus from the dead. No thread of evidence has yet been discovered in literary sources or archaeology that would disprove this statement. For 2,000 years, man has tried to take away the empty tomb. They have tried to come up with theories, and they cannot explain it because the tomb was empty. Jesus had risen. The empty tomb and Jesus' resurrection gives us a hope of a resurrection on the last day. Are you ready for this resurrection? Are you ready to meet the Lord? If you need your sins forgiven by baptism, so that you will be ready to meet the Lord when He returns, or you want the prayers of your church family, you can come as we stand and sing.